Hello there, welcome to episode 4 of The Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. I've been lucky enough to be a football commentator on local and national radio for over 20 years now, and I meet lots of wonderful people in this industry, this weird, weird industry that I'm in, who do exactly the same job as me, only an entirely different job, and have an entirely different story to tell about how they got there, how they've stayed there, and how they plan to keep on staying there. There are an archive of episodes that you can already hear. Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker were my first episode. You can find that where you found this podcast. Also, episodes with John Champion and Nigel Pearson. And also, the most recent one before this was Kevin Hatchard and Robin Cowan. Go and delve in at your leisure and enjoy. But let me introduce today's guests on The Commentator's Curse. First of all, a man who wins the award for sartorial elegance compared to any other commentator that sits in any press box, and he damn well knows it. The man that has given Tweed a new lease of life in this country. It is Nick Barnes of BBC Radio Newcastle. Nick, welcome to The Commentator's Curse.
Thank you very much. That's it. We can stop now. That's okay.
Well, yeah, okay. Thanks very much for
this. Let's get out while the going's good.
And also with us is, well, somebody I actually went to school with. Funnily enough, although he's always keen to remind everybody that he was 4 years younger than me.
And the rest.
And started his career as a football commentator before me. And he'll outlast me as well when he gets to the other end. He's been working for TalkSport since its inception, but he had some time away, worked for Absolute, worked for Capital Gold Radio in London and in the Midlands, which is where we first reconnected after our school days. Jim Proudfoot is with us on The Commentator's Curse. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Dan. So I was amazed that when you were giving Nick his introduction, I thought that was mine when you were talking about sartorial. When you mentioned Nick Barnes, it's like being at an award ceremony, and the winner is, what is not? That's not my name. What are you doing?
Well, I could see the consternation on your face when that was being read out, Jim. But you know, Nick, your Twitter handle, you know, Tweed Barnes. It sets it all up for what you are and the look that you cultivated. That we all enjoy down the years.
Yeah, well, it's one of them. I can't escape now. I mean, if I go anywhere and I'm not wearing tweed, it's honestly, it's not worth the hassle. So only the other week, we were at York for a pre-season friendly, and it was 28 degrees. And I was in a tweed jacket, and it was basically, I'm surprised I'm still here. But you know, you almost felt obliged to wear it, whatever the weather, because people expect it now. So it's become... On one hand, while it's, you know, it's lovely and I love tweed and I will always wear tweed, there are some days when you think, you know, I just wish it hadn't got this far.
They don't make tweed heated gilets yet, do they?
Well, to be honest, tweed, you don't need to heat them. On the right, if you get the right thickness of tweed, it's fine. But we won't go into the nuances and we won't go into, as everyone keeps talking about, tweed underwear. We haven't got that far yet.
God, no, that's a cul-de-sac we don't want to go down. Moving swiftly on, both of you actually, in terms of your youth and your upbringing, have a connection to the southwest of England because, of course, Nick, we know you well for everything you've done in the northeast for a very long period of time. And Jim, you're a national commentator and everyone knows you're a Torquay fan, but that genuinely comes from having lived a good portion of your youth in the southwest.
Well, not actually a good portion, a portion. Yeah, I'm a Southwest boy. And my mum's half of the family are all from the West Country. But I have very, very fleeting memories of living down there before we moved up to Solihull, in the Midlands, which is where I was brought up. And that's probably where I consider home. But, you know, some things you get stuck with. And then when I went back down to uni in the southwest, and I started working an extra in Torquay with the first two teams that I ever covered. So it was easy to sort of renew my relationship with, you know, watching Torquay. Particularly at the time, the Torquay team had a load of young Brummies in it, because, you know, I'm sure you're aware, Torquay basically is a retirement home for people that used to work in Longbridge. So there were a lot of sort of Brummie families down there anyway. And a lot of the young players, Chris Curran, Paul Hall, had been brought up in Birmingham. Darren Moore was first year YTS at the time, from Handsworth. And so I just naturally got on very well with those guys, and sort of the relationship with the club was reborn and has stuck. And I was going to say I've enjoyed it to this day. I've endured it to this day. But the last time I saw us play, we won. So I'm still on a high at the moment. I can't say that very often.
And Nick, Wanstead was where you were born in London.
Yeah,
you moved to the South West fairly soon after, or
not? Oh, I was only one when we moved down to Exeter. I mean, historically, my mother's from Exeter and her family were from Cornwall. And my dad was from London, but we moved down. He got a job in Exeter. So we moved to Exeter when I was one. So I was brought up in Exeter, basically. I mean, I was in Exeter until I went to university. So, yeah, I was brought up there and in Cornwall. It's interesting what Jim says about Birmingham and the South West. There is a real sort of, I've never really worked out why, but, you know, my mother's family all live in Bude, come from Bude in North Cornwall. And when you go to Bude in the summer, it is packed with Brummies. And I've never worked out. I even saw, this is bizarre, I even saw Dion Dublin pulling a granny trolley across the beach at Bude, which I did actually raise with him a few years later. And he admitted, yes, he was there with his family. And he was pulling one of those shopping trolleys behind him across the beach with all the beach gear in. But going back, you know, there is a connection between North Cornwall and obviously Jim talking about Torquay and the West Midlands. And I never really, whether it's the sort of building of the M5 and whether that was the conduit for, but I've never worked out why the South West, because you could have easily get to Wales from Birmingham, where you can get across to East Anglia and so on. But everyone seems to sort of gravitate down to Devon and Cornwall. I know a guy in Bude and he's in his 90s now, and he's a massive West Bromwich Albion fan. And, you know, he's still got his West Brom accent and everything, and he follows West Bromwich Albion. But it's an enigma to me. Maybe Jim can explain this.
Well, if you fill your car up with petrol in Birmingham, where'd you run out? Bude. I think it's probably as simple as that. You just stick it in the right direction.
Going north is uphill, so it's easy to go downhill.
Yeah, exactly that. You can coast the last 5 miles past Widmouth Bay, just down, and get yourself in there, no problem at all.
I think it started, Nick, with you're right, the M5 has got a lot to answer for it in that sense, because Weston-super-Mare and Breen and areas like that are also heavily populated with Brummies, because that's the nearest seaside resort to the city of Birmingham. It's like Skegness for Nottingham folk. You know, that's where they go. But yeah, I don't. And the funny thing is, I don't remember going to Weston once in my childhood. We used to have camping trips instead with my family that most definitely did not involve Breen Sands or anything like that.
At least from my point of view, in North Cornwall on a summer afternoon, it makes a change from seeing Man United and Liverpool shirts everywhere. It's all West Brom, Birmingham, and Coventry.
How utterly bizarre. So, Jim, you mentioned studying back where you were born and spent the very early part of your life. Was it Devon Air that was the radio station that you first worked for?
Yeah, I didn't mention studying, Dan. So I mentioned university, and the two are very, you know, weren't necessarily good bedfellows, which is how I ended up in broadcasting. I started in student radio, but the local radio station was the great Devon Air, which was very definitely an old-fashioned local radio station for local people. The kind of radio station you don't get anymore. It knew its audience very well, and it was loved, but it wasn't financially successful. And it ultimately ended up being one of the very first independent local radio stations to lose its franchise. But I was able to cut my teeth there. And that was the thing that in that part of the world, probably not too many people had aspirations to broadcasters. And as such, you could probably get through a few open doors quite quickly if you were lucky enough to meet the right people on the way. And I certainly was. In the likes of John Ayres, who was the sports editor, and then Hamish Marshall, who took over as the news editor there. And they were both absolutely fantastic, and I probably have never really thanked them enough for the help that they gave me to get me kick-started along the way. But I was in a position that when I was 19, I was a regular reporter. And in fact, at the time, the sports show, because John was being seconded to Capital Radio at the time. So the sports show on a Saturday afternoon, there were three of us, and we were all teenagers. And it was presented by Russell Fuller, who's now the tennis correspondent at the BBC, Jonathan Wall, who was the programme controller of Five Live, and I was the other one. So Jonathan was based up in Manchester. He tended to do the whoever was playing away from home, he'd report on them, I'd report on whoever was at home, and Russell would present it. And for the three of us, I know that it was a fantastic start in our career. Because with the best in the world, you're going to make mistakes when you're that age. And if you're only doing it in front of a small audience and a load of sheep, it probably makes it a lot easier than if you're doing it in sort of a more high-profile job. So it was a perfect starting ground for me. It was absolutely brilliant.
But going to the school that we went to, and I went to the same school as you, Jim, I knew that if I had shown any desire for broadcasting, I would have been gently ushered away from it. Were you encouraged in any way, or how obvious a path did it become to you?
It wasn't when I was at school, dance at all. It was only when I went. I'd always been interested in radio and had listened. I was an avid listener to BR&B, our local radio station, long before we both worked there, and loved it. I just used to have it on all the time, and it captivated me. So I had the interest in broadcasting as such, but it was never really that's what I want to go and do. But I did know by the time I was leaving school, my choice was going to Exeter, who had a great radio station. The other uni that I wanted to go to was York, who had a fantastic university television station. And I chose to go to Exeter for academic reasons, I guess, and just, I don't know, you get a feel for the place when you go around. But it was just a slight
football.
Because, well, I wouldn't go that far. But yeah, I mean, it appealed to me to go back to the West Country, you know, where I was from. I hadn't got any family down there at that stage, but I'm really not that close to Exeter. But it just made sense for me to go down there. And as I say, it's a sliding doors moment, because had I gone to York, I don't think I would have had the interest in working in the university television, or, you know, let's be blunt about it, I'm probably more suited to working on radio than television. What would I have ended up doing for a living? I don't know, but I can't imagine it would be this. And I can't imagine I'd have had the luck in starting that I had. So I was fortunate with the way that it all panned out. But it wasn't really until I went that was what I was going to do. I was either going to do something to do with numbers, maybe work in finance. I was toying with the idea potentially of being a professional musician. But
I'm still toying with it.
Well, yeah, but you say you're toying with it. You're much better at it than me. I would have been a bang average sit at the back orchestral player, and probably would have got bored very quickly. So it was really a non-starter, but it was something I was thinking about and was still heavily involved at that stage. But as soon as I started on the student radio, within 2 weeks, I knew this is what I want to do. I want to leave university with a career, and this is the career that I've chosen. And so from that point, it was full steam ahead in trying to make that happen at the expense of doing enough work for my degree. I didn't get my degree. I dropped out of uni. But I did enough in the 2 years that I was there to get myself a foothold in the industry. So that was how I sold it to my mum and dad anyway.
And I'm sure it passed muster with Stan. Nick, similar thing, university-based in terms of it, your beginnings?
No, this is bizarre. I mean, it's funny because Jim talked about Devon Air. I mean, like, when I was a teenager, Devon Air was starting up in Exeter, and it was a real thing. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, for, you know, we didn't have any sort of, for my age group, we had Radio 1, but we didn't have anything else. And a local radio station starting up, Devon Air was fantastic. My route in was completely opposite, really. I went to university in Kent and came back home to Exeter and didn't have any idea what I was going to do for a job, and didn't have anything lined up for the summer. A friend of mine then...
By the way, what year is this?
This is 1986. So I arrived back in Exeter in the summer of 86, and a friend of mine, her father, worked for the AA, the road people. And he said, look, Devonair, Plymouth Sound, Radio Devon, they're looking for someone this summer to do the travel reports on the radio. Do you fancy it? It was sheer nepotism. I mean, I had no experience in radio at all. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do it. Summer job. Sounds great. So I ended up doing the traffic reports on those three stations, Radio Devon, Plymouth Sound, and Devon Air. Now, Devon Air, now, this might be before Jim's time. It might not be. I can't remember. Devon Air used to have a guy called Glenn Richards. You know where I'm going with this, don't you? They had a presenter.
I have my own Glenn Richards anecdote as well, but I get the feeling that most of them probably go along the same line. So I will sit back.
Yeah, Glenn Richards was the Terry Wogan of Devon Air, softly spoken Irish and, you know, lovely voice. Anyway, to cut a long story short, one afternoon I got a message to say, would you please not refer to Glenn as Glenn? Will you please call him Glenda? And it was Glenda Richards from then on, as Glenn Richards was transitioning. I think we press leave it there, because of course then it hit the papers and it became a big, I think it became a big national story actually at the time, because it was so unusual. But from there, basically, I got offered a job as a technical assistant at Radio Devon. So my foot in the door was it literally in through the back door, being a technical assistant at Radio Devon. And like Jim says about people you used to work with, I used to work with a guy, or two guys, Martin Dean and Mark Tyler, who were the sports editor and sports reporter at Radio Devon. And they kindly, and they were brilliant, let me do sports reports. And back in the day, Jim, I remember, you'll remember, Dance, that, you know, that not many places used to do full commentary of teams back then, but they did a sports show. I mean, Jim alluded to it there with, you know, Jonathan doing the reporting from Manchester and Jim was down in the southwest and whatever. The station for the away team always needed a reporter. I'd end up going to Exeter, Torquay or Plymouth and being, if you like, the away reporter for the afternoon. And that was my first sort of taste of radio broadcasting. But I was lucky enough in the 2 years I was at Radio Devon to work with Jill Dando, Ben Bradshaw, who's now the MP in Exeter, Alan Dedicote, the voice of the Balls, and so on. We had the workplace for those 2 years was unbelievable. The talent that actually came out from Radio Devon and Exeter at that time was it was unbelievable foundation.
It's incredible, that hotbed of talent, from what Jim was saying with Russell Fuller and Jonathan Ward,
yeah.
What you've just mentioned there with Jill and Ben and Barry. I mean, good grief. For what is essentially, you know, a parochial part of the...
Yeah, it was weird. You get these moments in time, don't you? Travis Baxter was another one who set up Atlantic 252 at the time. Nicky Schiller, who's worked for many, many years in London at the BBC. I mean, the names, you know, they keep... We actually even had, at one stage, the guy that set up Sunday Sport, the newspaper. He came as a freelance and worked in the evenings. He would be ostensibly there to produce the breakfast show, but he would lay out all the pages of the Sunday Sport on the desks at Radio Devon, smoking a big fat cigar, while he was producing a newspaper as well. Mike Gabbett, who was involved in the 60s as a reporter in blowing the Sheffield Wednesday, the fraud, the money scandal, wasn't it, back in the 60s at Sheffield Wednesday. Anyway, he was one of the reporters at the time on that story, but he gravitated to become the sort of editor of the then sort of nascent Sunday Sport. Quite a character.
Moving on to kind of next steps, Nick, we all know about your connection with the North East and we will delve into that. But Jim, you did have a brief connection with the North East yourself because you went to work for TFM, which became eventually part of the Metro Radio yeah. group. But I'm assuming it was independent at that point of any parent ownership. What was your job up there?
Well, it's funny you talk about the ownership because the ownership change happened about 6 weeks after I got there. So yeah, when I went, I had applied, I left uni, I went to do a diploma in journalism at Falmouth. So I spent another year in the Southwest, and then applied for a full-time job at Devon Air doing news. And I thought, I'm laughing here. They need someone who can do news and sport. I know everybody. literally everybody. I've hardly been out of the building for 2 years. There were only two people going for the job, and I came second. Rightly so, I may add, because I knew the person that I was up against. I've been at college with them, and for what they needed as a news journalist, they employed the better candidate, without a shadow of a doubt. But that was a massive kick in the teeth for me, because I'd kind of gambled with everything, as I say, hadn't got a degree. I've got this journalism qualification. I had to make it work for me. And the job, the one job in the world I was most likely to get, I didn't get. And it was a massive problem. And I literally went back to Brum, and I was sat at my mum and dad's table and writing letters to everybody around the country. And I got an interesting set of responses. I wish I'd kept them. Some from people saying, what do you think you're doing? How have you got the temerity to write and apply for a job here? If we had any vacancies, don't you think we'd fill them? And the person that wrote me that is a very well-known name in the industry now, and I won't embarrass them by saying it, just in case I need to work for him again at some stage. But I got this reply from TFM. And again, I'd just been in the right place at the right time. The news editor was a guy called John Ogden, who was working his notice. He was going to go to work for the local BBC station. And they needed, because everybody was getting promoted, John Murray was going to become the new news editor. And everyone was shifting up one, and they needed someone in at the bottom. And they wanted somebody that could also do sport. So I just struck lucky. And it sounds a daft thing to say now, but when I sealed that envelope, I just had a feeling that was where I was going to end up. So I think I sent the letters off the week before Christmas. Week after Christmas, I was back down in Exeter. I got asked to go up for an interview the following day to drive to Stockton, which I did, which took most of the day. Got home, was told I got the job, and I started the following Monday. So it was sort of a big upheaval, but was brilliant. And I was doing news and sport. I very quickly realised that I wasn't cut out to be a news journalist. There were a couple of very harrowing stories on the patch within the opening 2 or 3 months. And it wasn't for me. I hadn't got the mental resolve for it. And so I sort of took a step away from that. I knew I wanted to go into sport full time, but Metro had taken over by that stage, and I was doing the odd bit for Metro, doing just occasional Sunderland games, occasional Middlesbrough games. Because Metro had taken over, they brought Mick Lowes in. They said to me that you're not ready. John Murray had also gone to the BBC. He said, you're not ready to, at the age of 21, to be doing a club, the profile in Middlesbrough. I said, that's fine, but I want some opportunities. And I was getting a few, but they brought Mick Lowes in to do the Middlesbrough games. Mick had been at Capital, and Mick was still very good mates with Jonathan Pearce, heard that they needed somebody, rang him up and said, look, get this 21-year-old out of the office because he's doing my head in. And so I applied for the job in London and got it. But without that 6 months up in the northeast, 7 months up in the northeast, I wouldn't have been able to get into London. And it was, I mean, my dad, as you know, my dad's a northerner. He's a Cumbrian, but had lived himself, had been brought up and was schooled in Newcastle. So it's a part of the world that I had an affinity with anyway. And I loved it. It's very different. The northeast is very different from Birmingham, very different from the southwest. And just, as a part of the world, I adored it, still do. It's just great. And the way people live their life, I think it's fantastic. They work hard and they play hard, and it's just everybody. You're always on the front foot with everybody. Until you such time that you annoy them, they're your best mate. And it's great. I love it. I love it up there. And I've never moved back. I can't see that I ever will now. I left in 1994, but it was... I look back on it, as I'm sure you can tell, with a huge degree of fondness, my time on that.
Well, Nick, you're still there, and I'm sure what you've just heard there from Jim, you can wholeheartedly echo for the length of time you've spent up in the northeast. obviously most of the time covering Sunderland, but also you were telling me before we started this chat that, that Carlisle was an early port of call for you. There's Jim talking about Cumbria, where he's dancing from.
I mean, interesting, because I lived for 25 years in Cumbria. I mean, bizarrely, from Exeter, I've spent more time now living in the north than I did being brought up in the southwest. I lived for 25 years in Cumbria. I've been living in the northeast for 10 years now, but I've been working in the northeast for 20 odd years. I moved to Cumbria. I got, to cut a long story short, I ended up doing the sport on Radio Cumbria and covering and starting commentary with Carlisle United. Did 7 seasons with Carlisle under Michael Knighton before I was, about to be banned. And then moved across to the northeast to cover Newcastle for 5 years. But for the last 19 years now, I've been covering Sunderland. And Jim's absolutely right. I mean, for someone from the south to move somewhere like the north and I hear all the, and you travel up with all the stories about northerners and, you know, if you're from the south, they'll chew you up and spit you out for breakfast. It couldn't be further from the truth. I've never met, you know, Cumbria especially, living there. The sense of community in Cumbria is unbelievable. My kids are Cumbrian, so I've always got that connection. I mean, they're in their early 20s now, but and the northeast, yeah, Jim summed it up. I mean, they're your best friends. I mean, again, I think that's something that's so special about football in the northeast. It's that sense of community. The clubs belong to the people, very much so. It's a very strong identity people have with their football clubs, which is why they get so, you know, animated about everything that happens at the football club. I know Newcastle's such a, I mean, Ruud Gullit always used that sort of fishbowl analogy. But you're right, you know, I always remember when any story in Newcastle, you can hear it at, say, 11 o'clock in the morning, whatever the story might be. By 12 o'clock, everyone knows the story. Every news agent, every taxi, everything in Newcastle has a black and white scarf or shirt or badge or postcard. It's so, you know, it's so defined by the football club. And likewise in Sunderland, it's the same thing. It's that same connection. It's an extraordinary part of the world.
By the way, I'm not letting that slide, that you can just slip that in, that you nearly got banned by Michael Knighton. I've got to delve a little deeper into that. There was one of those great characters.
Yes, he was. And it was an extraordinary roller coaster ride, those 7 seasons with Michael Knighton. In those 7 seasons, I don't think I had a season without a relegation or a promotion. So that was for starters. He had 2 Wembley finals in that as well, their first Wembley final, and Michael Knighton, who was an absolute character. It was starting to fall apart for him after 3 or 4 years. There were lots of shenanigans going on. There was lots of question marks over funding of the building of the new stand at the ground, which, if you know, if you've been to Brunt Park, is out of kilter with the rest of the ground, which is sort of a metaphor for Michael Knighton, really. And it was starting to fray, and he'd sort of lost the trust, I think, of most of the players and staff and managers. He certainly didn't trust Mervyn Day, who was the manager in 1997, to the point where he was tapping all the phones at the football club and listening in on Mervyn's conversations, and I was involved in those phone calls. And it led to, in the end, Michael Knighton sacking Mervyn Day, and it was like the night of the long knives, the backroom staff, and I get a phone call telling me I'm no longer welcome at the club. Although actually, I didn't get banned that season, bizarrely. Michael Knighton took over as manager, brought in 2 of the, one was the football and the community officer, the other was the youth team manager, and that became the management team. First game that Michael Knighton was in charge of was away at Wickham, who hadn't lost at home for a year. And Michael Knighton rolls up and he tells the players there are no uncertain terms to talk to me. He catches one of them talking to me and nearly got thrown out of the team for the day. And then his team go on to beat Wickham 4-1. Matt Janssen, the great Matt Janssen, scoring 1 or 2 of the goals. And Michael Knighton got all the players to line up in a row and take a bow for the away fans. And as Michael Knighton walks off the pitch, he sees me in the stand and sticks 2 fingers up to me. The steward says, "Oh, don't you worry. What comes round, comes round." But it led to a massive row with him in the car park. And subsequently, our relationship sort of ended that day. And that was sort of early season. I learnt at the end of the season that I was to be banned the next season. So I moved, basically.
Anybody who isn't aware of Michael Knighton's history, look him up, because there's some extraordinary tales to tell, not just about his time at Carlisle, but there was a story about being abducted by aliens that he claimed. There was his link to Manchester United that very nearly...
Yeah, well, that's extraordinary. I mean, in fairness, I mean, back when he took over at Carlisle, he just sort of finished at Man United and that whole... He actually had, when you look back historically, his ideas were right. I mean, he knew that Manchester United was a cash cow. He absolutely nailed the potential at Manchester United, and he was trying to get people on board to buy into his consortium to take it over. And he nearly did it. I mean, he nearly achieved it, but for one reason or another, it didn't quite come off. And it might have been a completely different story now down the line, because he had some sort of fundamentally sort of some, you know, good business ideas for running the football club, which all changed because the Premier League came along and so on. But fundamentally, he wasn't, you know, far off the mark. And he was certainly right about the potential at Manchester United. But he ended up at Carlisle. He'd looked at a number of clubs. I think Northampton Town was another club. He wanted to pick a team up which was completely on their uppers and had, you know, were virtually bankrupt, had no money. And he wanted to prove his business acumen by taking one of these clubs on. And he took Carlisle on. And yeah, we had, you know, it was fantastic, phenomenal success initially. He was getting crowds of 9,000, 10,000. There was a real wave of euphoria over Carlisle, and they were getting the crowds back. But for want of not buying one striker in the season they first went up into the then Division 3, the whole thing crumbled. Because if he paid £60,000 for one player, I think it would have been a different story. They'd probably stayed in Division 3. They'd have built on that fan base, and you know, they'd probably be in the Championship now. But that didn't happen. But he had some good ideas. But then again, he went off the rails. He said, talking about seeing the aliens. I think now he's an artist now, and he's got an artist studio, and he makes his big triptychs and all sorts. He's meant to be coming back to Carlisle at some point to do an evening at Carlisle. It's be interesting to see what the reaction of the fans are.
That'll sell some to him. Now, going back to you, Jim, during the course of the 90s, and this does have relevance to Nick as well to an extent, you mentioned that Jonathan Pearce brought you into Capital Gold initially in London. And this was at a time when commercial radio really started ramping up its desire to buy up football rights and exclusivity as well. And you experienced that at both Capital Gold London and when you came back to the Midlands to work for BR&B and Capital Gold in Birmingham, because Tom Ross too had exclusivity deals that he had tied up with certain clubs. So there really was a BBC ILR war going on in the 1990s?
I'm thinking back to when we were at Capital. My first year at Capital, we had the rights to cover any Premier League match we wanted. So we used to do Monday night games. It was Sheffield Wednesday against Forest on a Monday. We'd do it. Right. So it wasn't just London. And that didn't last very long. I think that probably only lasted my first year there. So that was the 94-95 season. But yeah, Richard Park was the driving force behind it, and had identified Jonathan as the man, the character to make this work on air, which he did sensationally. You speak to any, you know, London football fan of a certain age, and you know, he is an absolute icon to them. High octane style that was worlds apart from anything that there was at the time. Particularly on the local BBC station. At that stage, Capital owned, Capital as they still were at that stage, owned a certain number of stations. They had, funnily enough, an interest in Devonair. They had the stations on the South Coast. So Power FM, Ocean FM, and the medium wave spin-off of that was called South Coast Radio. And I ended up coming down, which is, I live in Hampshire now, and that's where I first came down, to be the sports editor there, a small station that had Southampton and Portsmouth, but not exclusively. And it was, it was never nasty by any stretch of the imagination, but there was a real competitive edge to the coverage, us against them. In those days, then I moved up to Birmingham, and it was the same, trying to get exclusive deals to do the clubs, and it was BR&B against Radio WM. And I think that that was, we talked about luck a number of times, but being the age that we are, I think really helped getting in the first place, because there was the independent radio structure. There were more jobs for people. Now that ILR doesn't cover football by and large, certainly in the same way. And I mean, I still can't get my head around the fact that Radio City doesn't cover Liverpool and Everton. I will never, ever be able to understand that as a business decision. But you know, when we were growing up, you knew all the sports editors at all the stations around the country, and the vast majority of them have ended up on television and made a massive success. But that's not there anymore. So that pathway just doesn't exist for youngsters coming into to the industry in the same way that it did for us. But yeah, back, it was war with a very small W rather than a capital W, but it was fascinating time.
I think the point I should make at this juncture is that it might have been war in the boardrooms, but certainly not in the press box the differing factions. It was it always struck me as being very much hands across the airwaves. I can only think of one individual during my entire time, you know, at the BBC who was condescending and downright rude. I don't need to name him, but he stood out like a sore thumb. But Nick, in your position on the other side of the fence, as a BBC employee, you know, you had a lot of competition. There was obviously Metro Radio. You had, all sorts of people trying to take listeners away from what you were doing.
Jim is absolutely right. I mean, that period, I mean, I think if you try to explain to someone now what it was like, it's quite difficult because we just don't have that landscape anymore. But at the time, it was fervent. You know, there was a very much a determination to, you know, to dominate, if you like. And you're right, Ian. I mean, there was no sort of animosity on the ground. We all mucked in together and got on with the job. But certainly when I arrived at Radio Newcastle, we only had second half commentary rights, which is virtually worthless, you know. I mean, but we were grateful for that. You know, at least you could, you know, you still commentated in the first half and you put together a sort of highlights going into the second half. But, you know, because Metro had the rights and they had the rights to Sunderland and Newcastle. So we were very much in the back seat for several years. And then I'm not quite sure whether it was because ILR started to pull out of doing games and pulling out of football, which was a sort of drip feed process, because it started to happen at a couple of radio stations. And then we've seen this landscape change because the owners of the radio stations have become sort of global, haven't they? And that has meant that they haven't seen football. As someone said, one of the reasons is that you can't nail a football match now down to 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon for the advertising rights. They're all over the shop. And so for a radio station which is relying on advertising, that's not really good. You know, you want a set time when you know you can hit an audience and get that audience for your advertising. So yes, that worked for the BBC, but I quite agree with Jim. I think it's, you know, when, you know, I, as I mentioned earlier, grew up, my first radio station I listened to was Devon Air. The connection which some places have with radio stations, in Liverpool with Radio City is, you know, probably the biggest example. It seems extraordinary that bosses at those stations don't see the importance of the football clubs to those radio stations. But we eventually, you know, we did get full commentary, and we were competing with ILR then as well. But I actually always, you know, from my point of view, when I moved to Sunderland, it was Simon Crabtree who was the commentator at Century, which was the sort of took over from Metro. We never saw ourselves as, I think, competitors. I think we were just two very different styles of commentary teams. And I, you know, to this day, I mean, people still say, well, wish we had have Crabbers back. And I quite understand that, because, you know, the audience is so diverse. You know, people who like Crabbers probably don't like me, and people who like me probably don't like Crabbers. But we should all be out there for everybody to have that choice, from my point of view. And I, you know, I think the world's a sort of poorer place for that lack of competition, if you like.
That's an interesting point, actually, that I think it bears reiterating just how well, because it's such a small industry, the vast majority of us get on with each other. And I suppose we're in a similar position now, working for TalkSport. Are we competitors to Five Live? We very seldom do the same games these days, but there will be times that we do. But I know that if we had a problem, or if they had a problem in terms of access, equipment failing, information, inside stories, you share everything. You just, because you don't know when it's going to be you that needs the favour. And we all look after each other. And I speak to people, some people in newspapers, some, you know, some of my mates, they can't get their head round that. They can't understand how we can all be genuinely really good friends.
And I thought, well, part of it, Jim, is because I think we're all listeners. You know, yeah. You said yourself about getting into radio. You just felt at home with it because you love radio. I love radio. I love listening to the radio. I'm a listener. I listen to Talk Sport as much as I listen to Five Live because I want to hear the football. I don't. To me, it doesn't matter. It's Talk Sport, whatever. I want to hear football on the radio. So I will listen to, and I think that's how we work as well as, you know, as the commentators. We all work together with the same aim. We're giving someone a service, and it doesn't, you know, why make someone else's life difficult? Because you know somewhere down the line, you're going to have a problem or it's going to be, and you need help. Let's just, you know, muck in together.
Spot on. I can think of only about a couple of seasons ago when I went to Elland Road to do a commentary in my my Glensound broadcast box, our sort of magical box that allows us to talk to the nation, just it fallen over and refused to do anything. And Adam Pope from BBC Radio Leeds, who was way down the other end of the gantry at Elland Road, for those that know the gantry, it's runs right along the John Charles main stand, and the BBC and TalkSport are as far apart as it's possible to be. But he was straight over with his spare Glensound box without a moment's hesitation. Yeah, Dance, that should work for you. I mean, you know, he didn't have to do that.
No, it's not an unwritten rule that, I mean, we had 2 or 3 years ago, maybe a bit longer now, we had a BBC boss, I'm not going to name him, but we were sent out these yellow stickers. We had to stick on our ISDN box, is the point where you know, plug in, saying this is a BBC box, nobody else to use it. And I'm thinking, what's all this about? I mean, it, you know, ultimately, we know how fragile ISDN is. So 9 times out of 10, most of the boxes don't work anyway. So you know, you're sort of basically trying to find one that works. You help each other out. I just thought that this is divisive. I didn't agree with that at all. I just felt this is someone up high just trying to sort of put their big size 12 boots in and, you know, make, you know, establish why they're in the job. But it was, yeah. It's not helpful.
Now, Jim, our paths crossed when I started doing, I started my strange and convoluted route into radio, doing silly sketches for Tom Ross in, I think it was 97 I started doing those. And by that time, you'd replaced Ian Crocker as BRNB and Capital's lead commentator. And that was only for a couple of years, because then the opportunity to join TalkSport came about.
Yeah, kind of. I was working on the South Coast and I got married and I came back from my honeymoon and went back into the office, and there was kind of a silence when I walked back in. You think, that's great. Thanks very much indeed. Yeah, it was a nice honeymoon. Thank you. And I got whisked into the boss's office and she said, you don't work here anymore. You work in Birmingham. What? I've just got, literally just got married. 4 or 5 weeks ago. And they said that Croc was leaving. He was going to Sky. And my contract was with the company, the parent company, and not with the entity on the South Coast. And I was to work as directed. And you've got to go to Birmingham. So, right. Okay. Now, my then wife didn't want to go. And it didn't cause a problem, that would be overplaying it, but we loved it in Hampshire. We hadn't been living there very long, but we'd made some fantastic friends, and you know, she was cast in the wool southerner and just didn't want to move. So that put me on the back foot before we started, really. So I went up and was working for Tom, but was I'd been kind of around that time I'd been tapped up to go elsewhere, which didn't happen, but I was always expecting that it would. And so I've never told Tom this, but I took the job expecting I would only be there a matter of weeks. I was there a year, but then Manchester United Games, Century launched in Manchester in the Northwest, and they had a deal to do Manchester United, and they approached me. And so it was because of the nature of how it was working, I could move, funnily enough, I could move back south because I was only doing the games. So I could commute up and down the country just to do the Man United games, and it gave me the opportunity to go freelance. I love working for BR&B, it was the station I grew up listening to. But it was just the wrong circumstances, the wrong time for me to be there. I'm immensely proud of having worked for him. I love Tom Dealey, and he was a great fella to work for and to learn from. But it was just for me, it was being at the right place at the wrong time. For those circumstances. So I then ended up doing Manchester United for a year, and then Talk Sport came along. There were changes in Manchester as well. New management came in and rightly looked at the budget and the fact that they were blowing money on a freelance commentator who was doing nothing else other than commentating for them, and they thought they could use the money better. They were probably right, almost certainly right. So I ended up going to Talk Sport in 1999. August 1999, and I've been there most of the time ever since. I've done so four. I had 4 years away, but I've been there since 99, bar the 4 years.
Well, that's right, because when I started bumping into you again in the press box, you were doing full commentaries. I think Chelsea and Tottenham. I think Talk Sport had rights for the London.
And Fulham as well. That's right. Yeah, I was just on the 1089 transmitter in London. So I mean that still went some distance, probably down most of the south coast, all of Kent, out towards East Anglia. So you were getting a big audience. It was local radio, but I was Alvin Martin and I, and we would do whenever Chelsea, Spurs, and Fulham were playing, we would do it. So which was fantastic.
And. Nick, before you came on, before we started recording this, Nick was reminding us all of when you did unofficial commentary on a major tournament. TalkSport, of course, now have been doing official commentaries. You and I spent time, wonderful time out in South Africa, Jim, 11 years ago. And I'll always cherish that trip, particularly, even though you were forced to share with me in our... there was... Hotel rooms were... The commentary position that you had to utilize at Euro 2000, which must have been very uncomfortable for you to do, because you know we can laugh about it now, but at the time, you're being told by management, right, you're doing this commentary, and you have to say a number of times during the course of this is unofficial, blah 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 blah.
Yeah, well, that's how it turned out. That wasn't how they envisaged it to start with. It was. We want to do this. This was Calvin McKenzie. He didn't believe in, and apologies if I don't get this quite right, but basically the EBU, the European Broadcast Union, prevented TalkSport from being a part of it. It was kind of a closed shop. They didn't want TalkSport involved. But to get the rights for the Euros, you had to deal with the EBU. So TalkSport felt that they were being unfairly and unlawfully precluded from broadcasting the tournament. So they decided they'd do it anyway. But they said, if you do it from the studios in London, people will see you going about your daily business. So we're going to do it from Amsterdam. From a hotel, no one will ever know. Okay, well, when no one will ever know lasted about 10 minutes of the first game before everybody knew everything. And so it became very quickly a legal hot potato. And the BBC were rightly protecting their rights. And we got to a stage where we had to say, famously, this "we are not the BBC" was the first thing we had to say. We had to say it within a minute of the game starting, three times a half, and within 30 seconds of every goal going in. We had to say, "We are not the BBC. We are very naughty boys," effectively, was the rest of it. I can't remember what the phrase was. It wasn't cowboy coverage, but it was, I mean, what had been agreed was really damning to have to read out. And Alan Parry and I were the commentators. And, you know, AP was very established by that stage. I wasn't. And I was thinking, well, this is a great opportunity for me. I'm commentating on national radio. I'm in the Netherlands for a month, which is fantastic. But do I kind of really need to be doing this? Because of the, you know, is it going to be adversely affecting my career? That was a genuine concern. There were a load of crowd effects as well. So we had no crowd noise. So what they had done, they recorded long before FIFA, they had this soundtrack of all the things that could possibly happen. They had a referee's whistle. They had a crowd. They had a Mexican wave sound effect. So they had all these buttons that they would press. So they had the sort of the genuine general hubbub of crowd noise. And then they would have a goal going in. So someone scored and we'd shout. And with about a second and a half later, a button would be pressed and you'd hear, "Hooray!" in the background. Or, you know, it sounded like a crowd would sound.
Yeah.
But you think this is an accident waiting to happen somewhere. And what and how it happened was that the Dutch were involved in a penalty shootout. And I'm sure the people that were pressing the buttons wouldn't mind me saying they weren't necessarily all football fans. So they were reading the game, but not in the way that a football fan would. And their reaction wasn't necessarily the same. And the Dutch were playing at home. And they were in this penalty shootout. I think it was against Italy, but apologies, that's not right. Anyway, the Italians missed the decisive penalty. So what's the reaction? The reaction is going to be mayhem. It's going to be absolute euphoria. Button gets pressed, and all we hear in the background is, "Oh." It's like someone had just failed to win the speedboat on Bullseye. is the best comparison I can make. And I started laughing. Because what could you do? I'm sat in a hotel room and this has just become a joke. And there's more to it. We had a young legal attorney with us who was making sure, basically, that we're doing it. There's more chance of him buying a drink than there was of me being able to salvage my career after that. I was genuinely convinced that this is me done. I'm stuck now. And it very nearly went to court. And I was going to get called as an expert witness. I was 27. I knew nothing. I was looking at all these people that the BBC were going to wheel out, all of whom were like broadcasting gods in management. And I was like the expert witness for talks. Well, thankfully, it never went to court. But I think it only got settled about 48 hours before it did. Yeah. So it was a very interesting episode. And we had things like that. We had two big screens in there, and one of them would invariably end up showing anything other than football, and you had to try and commentate on what was happening on the one whilst commentating on the football at the same time. We were stir crazy by the end of it, but it was an interesting episode.
Well, look, TalkSport, of course, has moved on quite considerably.
Oh, yes.
And let's have it right, since the days of Kelvin and taking on the EBU. Nick, from your point of view, you've had a very steady time of it up in the Northeast, working for BBC Newcastle, covering Sunderland. And one of the great things about what you've managed to do is you've also cultivated a long-standing pundit relationship with Gary Bennett. Because often, Jim and myself, when we're doing commentaries, we work with a whole number of equally great, you know, pundits, whether I'm working with Perry Groves or David Connolly, whether Jim's working with Stuart Pearce or Matt Holland. But you and Benno have struck up a very unique friendship that plays out on air.
I think we're like an old married couple. You know, we could be a sitcom, to be honest, the pair of us. But you're right. I mean, I think that's one of the things I've enjoyed over the one of the decisions I took, I think, over the years is that rather than move to Five Live or whatever and be going here, there and everywhere every week. I actually like the continuity and knowing, being able to predict, whilst it's unpredictable in so many ways through a season, because you never know when games are going to be moved, I like the predictability, if you like, of following the one club through and having that relationship with Benno and with the fans. And that for me is what sort of, you know, drives me on. But that relationship with Benno, yeah, is unique. It is unique. We do get on really, really well. And it's something, you know, when you speak to the listeners, the fans of Sunderland, I think if it wasn't he and I together, if Benno wasn't doing it, it was someone else, it wouldn't be the same. I think we've become the sort of voices of the club, if you like. We are intangibly linked. I think we're a one, if you like. We couldn't sort of split that relationship up.
Well, you are linked with Sunderland inextricably, and the Sunderland Till I Die documentary kind of cemented that, because you were front and centre as one of the major talking heads. And here we are, a fourth successive season for Sunderland at League One level, which is something I'm sure you never imagined, or nobody on Wearside imagined would be the case.
No, we were talking before we started recording, weren't we, about, you know, Accrington at the weekend. And if you'd said to me 4 years ago, we'd be playing Accrington again on Saturday and Accrington would be second, would have pinched myself. I mean, and I think most Sunderland fans, when Sunderland got relegated, made the brazen assumption that Sunderland would bounce straight back. And it's just not been the case. I mean, the club was so sort of rotten, if you like, over the last decade. It's fallen apart so much structurally and so on that it was, you know, it was a basket case. I think we're only starting to see it recovering now. But it's been a tough 4 years, I think, more for the supporters than for Benno and I. I mean, we do a job, you know, we're professional in sort of wherever we go, we do the job. And I've actually quite enjoyed sort of the football at this level. I mean, I had 7 years at Carlisle. So it's not as though it's alien to me to be sort of going around Rochdale, Accrington, wherever it might be. But
Accrington has its own special...
That's part of it. At Accrington, there's three old ladies, four old ladies, whatever, who sit in front of us at Accrington, and all you hear through the commentary is these old ladies bickering and chatting. I mean, broad Lancashire accents. And there was an old guy with them the other year who, bear in mind, John Coleman's been in charge for nearly 1,000 games at Accrington, has pulled them out from non-league into League One on virtually no money. And this 80-year-old guy turns around to Benno and I at half-time. This is the worst manager we've ever had. In 63 years I've been watching this. This is the worst manager we've ever had. Doesn't know what he's doing. But the language is a bit more colourful than that. And Benno and I were just stopped. It just stopped us in our tracks. I mean, what can you say? But the real characters. I mean, that's the beauty of lower league football, is it's its own community, if you like. And they are sort of, they in a way, a metaphor for that.
I've had a run-in with a Millwall fan at West Brom. I wish I could tell the story, but the language is just too much. I also remember nearly being hit by a Derby County supporter at Pride Park when Walsall won a late penalty. Lee Bradbury won a penalty for Walsall. And this 20-something lad in a duffel coat took exception to my excitement, for the benefit of Capital Gold listeners, that Walsall had won a penalty with a chance to win the game. And he swung a right at me. He missed. He got dragged out. I don't know, Jim, whether you've encountered any, well, the sort of close encounters none of us want.
I've never come close to being hit, I don't think. I've fallen out with supporters a few times. I've had to pull a European Cup winner out of a fight at Highfield Road. And he would have won the fight as well. We were saving the fan, we weren't saving him. even though he was probably in his 60s at the time. I've had abuse, loud verbal abuse. And you kind of get to recognise the fans that are going to do it. There was a fellow that in a camel head coat that used to sit right next to the press box at Highbury, who had the filthiest language I've ever heard in my life, and was sat right next to where the only place the effects microphone could go. And he would always lull you into a false sense of security because he'd never get there until 2:50. So you think, he's not coming. We're all right. He's excellent. He's not going to be here. And he'd turn up. sometimes you'd even turn up late and you go, oh no. And the first thing you do, you catch your eye, look across, catch your eye, and you go, oi, Campbell, you. And then put the expletive in a car. Not again. Excuse, sir, would you mind moderating your language, please? It's, you know, this is going out to 40 million people, however many people we used to pretend listen to us. But it was just, yeah, there were some characters.
It sounds like Big Vern out of
we were
he looked a bit like him as well, yeah.
We were at Burnley once, and they sit right next to you, you know, on the steps. They're literally across the steps. And there was one Burnley fan next to us one day giving it everything in the first half. And they kept on looking across at Benno and I and giving it the works. And we thought half time is going to come and this is going to be interesting, to say the least. So we were luckily Benno was on my left. I thought if anything happens, I've got a protector here. Half time, Julie arrives. This guy leans across the step. I knew it was coming, and he comes like, you two are the two best dressed commentators I've ever seen here.
Well, there you go. The element of surprise. It's a wonderful thing. Listen, we're running short of time, gents, but I do want to ask one last question that kind of links you both in a vague kind of way in terms of the way you prepare for games, because Jim, Nick, your styles of preparation couldn't be any different. Jim, I've known that you have a wonderfully elaborate system that you have, spreadsheets, printouts, and a database that you utilise for every game that you do. And it's brilliant. And I tip the hat because I just wouldn't have the patience that you clearly have to do that. And then, Nick, from your point of view, you have these lovingly created season books where the artwork, all done by hand, you draw the team logo that you're going to visit and everything's sectioned off with coloured pens. One of them actually was, I don't know whether it was stolen or whether it was just mislaid at one point, but that became a major story in the North East.
Yeah, my car was broken into and the bag was stolen. And they dumped the bag, they took everything else, left the matchbook in the bag. And I don't know what that tells you about the matchbook, but I was lucky to get it back, to be honest. But yeah, I'd have been inconsolable if I'd lost it. The only reason I do it that way is because I wouldn't know what spreadsheets. That is, to me, it's like technology and computers. I just do not understand them. Yeah, I could never. People go about, oh yeah, if you get a spreadsheet, you can do all that. I'm thinking, how? What? It's just total sort of like word blindness when I see a spreadsheet. I don't know. I just don't know how they work.
I did a thing once. I've never told you this, Nick. Going back, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, where I was doing some filming. I'm sorry, this sounds like a horrendous name drop. It's not meant to. But I was doing some filming, and to make it look accurate, they wanted to have some commentary notes in front of me so that the camera would sort of look, would sort of maybe start on my face and would go down to make it look realistic. And I'm sitting there, so yeah, that's a really good idea. And anyway, it was a copy. I don't know where they got it from. It was a copy of one of your match notes. And there's no missing them, obviously. That's Nick's. So I'm spending all the time going, oh, I wonder who's playing right back that day, and sort of looking at the Sabutio men that you so lovingly draw. It was just really weird. It's just, so you're famous. You're famous in the world of entertainment.
Yeah.
Two of the books are going to be appearing at the Design Museum in London next year. There's a big exhibition about broadcasting and the change in communication over the years. Anyway, they're taking two of the books. Two of them did appear at the National Museum in Bradford the other year for a similar sort of exhibition. But
was there ever with like Len Ganley gloves just turning the page?
Oh yeah. Oh, when you take them down, they had to wear white gloves and that. Insurance, the works. I'm thinking, oh, what? Hang on a minute. I mean, it's a working notebook, really.
Family heirloom, that, by the sounds of it, Nick. You know, that's, you know, something to hand down from generation to generation. How long does it take you, typically, to get that double-page spread prepared?
I mean, there's a bit of cheating going on now because I do draw the club crest. But, of course, once you've drawn it once, you can photocopy it for the next time. So that actually is a complete title. I can see Jim's face. He looks absolutely horrified.
No.
But,
I'm not having that.
So that's a real time saver. But I do have a couple to draw this season. Cheltenham and Cambridge, I've not beat. You know, they'll be fresh, in inverted commas, But generally, if I haven't drawn the crest, it's sort of 3 or 4 hours to do the page. And
I think there's a three word phrase coming from either Jim or myself. The game's gone. I think. Jim,
so Nick, even you do cut and paste. I mean, that is
it is. But it's on the basis that I did do the original. At least it's like a print. It's like a print of an original piece of art. That's my argument.
That is you justified yourself. That's fine, but I'm heartbroken.
Well, look, gents, we've gone over an hour, and as usual, as I'm discovering with these chats with good people like yourself, I could happily go on for another hour and still barely scratch the surface of what you guys do. Nick, obviously, good luck for the rest of the season with Sunderland. Maybe, Lee Johnson can get you over the line this year in what is probably the most competitive League One I've ever seen. Mm. Certainly in terms of the strength of those teams around you. It's not going to be easy, is it?
No, it's not. And, this is Sunderland, so it will be a roller coaster. It won't be straightforward. I think that's a guarantee.
And Jim, obviously, everything keeps you busy because there's TV work for Premier League productions as well as the great stuff you do with Talk Sport. So where are you this weekend? What have you got planned?
I'm at Chelsea Saturday. I've got Sunday off, which is great. And then it sort of starts ramping up the pressure with the Champions League starting. So it's a busy week coming up. But fantastic, can't wait.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can't wait. I mean, I've been self-isolating for 10 days. I can't wait to get back to it, doing Birmingham Derby on Friday night and then a bit of Arsenal on Saturday. It's been horrible being cooped up for 10 days, but that's the rules. But there we go. Gents, I'm sure I'll see you in a press box in the not-too-distant future and we can catch up still further. But thank you both for being on the Commentator's Curse.
Pleasure. Really enjoying it. Thank you.
Jim Proudfoot, Nick Barnes, who've been my guests on this episode of the Commentator's Curse. Thank you for listening all the way through. If you've got this far, there is the archive, as I mentioned earlier, of episodes 1, 2 and 3 that you can check out at your leisure. And episode 5 will be along very, very soon. Once again, my thanks to Jim Proudfoot and Nick Barnes. I'm Ian Danter, signing off. This has been the Commentator's Curse.